It's not a family, it's a business. But equally, life is difficult. Life can be deeply challenging and very existential. And I think it's important to listen to people and make them feel heard. You know, they can be vulnerable enough to talk about something difficult that's happening to them inside or outside of work. And then equally, at the right moments, make that work really enjoyable and fun and a little bit silly. I channeled that my creative DNA, if you like, into that joy of building businesses, both on a macro and a micro level. So macro for me, how do you think about designing an organization? And then micro more, you know, how do we tell the story of this business? You inherently have to clarify what you're doing to tell a good story. And so it's almost a bit of a proxy for.
Welcome. Thank you so much for checking down south of the river.
Thank you for having me.
So, what should people know about the one and only Katie Turner at this stage of your life?
I'm Katie. I'm a human. I am at an interesting point in my life, I guess. I've done lots of different things, so I always find it quite hard to give a neat answer to this question. So perhaps I'll talk more about some of the things that I love. I'm a creative person. I'm an artsy person. I love art and language and words and music. I love building businesses and have been involved in building a number of businesses over the years. I love my family. I live for family and friends. And I would like to, I guess, generally work on the world being a kinder place. So I guess those are some of the things about me.
Do you have a vision statement for the world being kinder?
Not really. No, I haven't gone that far. I think I believe a lot in laughter, and that's one way for us all to connect more closely and bringing fun to things, I guess. I mean, we haven't really explicitly talked about work yet, but I really believe that work should be this joyful endeavor. And if we can create environments for people to work in where that joy is a core part of the experience that they have, then that's one way. I mean, you know, I'm not going to suddenly start working in the charity sector or, you know, go into aid. I'm a business person. I've always worked in business. I've always worked in the private sector. So that's the realm that I operate in. If I can do something in that realm through joy and through stories and through bringing fun, then I guess I would consider that to be my contribution.
I didn't expect to be sharing this quite yet, but I think given that on the topic of fun, I think it's only appropriate to share what Mark said about you. Let's press play. Oh, you might have to turn it up.
I mean, she's honestly probably one of the best people I've ever worked with. We just were very closely aligned, kind of similar personalities. You know, had like both had high standards, high expectations, but of each other and the rest of the team. She had like an amazing skill to kind of steer conversations in the right direction and also just kind of frame and contextualize conversations before we entered into them. She brought her personality to work quite strongly. And I think everyone in the team would just, you know, she's like a fun person to have in the team, good sense of humor, you know, cracking silly jokes, and generally sort of just say her, she's like a silly person, but in a good way. You know, navigating a bit of a fine line, I suppose, as to when, you know, you've got to be serious. If we've got our investors in the room, and you know, you're trying to win a deal and or things like that, you obviously turn it on. She was like very tuned as to when to, you know, what cards to play, essentially.
Sort of like both emotionally and professionally intelligent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I would say high EQ.
Yeah.
Okay. Very high EQ, and that, particularly in terms of dealing with the partners again, and like being able to head off some of those more challenging moments, but also with the team as well. So, like between us, there were, you know, we had like four people kind of reporting into us, and I think she was a really strong line manager to these people, because she, you know, feels passionate in like developing people and setting them good objectives and making sure they've got all the resources that they need. But also, she's like pretty good at giving people feedback, but not making them feel shit about it.
That's lovely. That's, to my mind, one of the biggest compliments somebody can pay me, is to call me silly. It's generally, if somebody feels that way about me, it makes me so, so happy.
Why?
Because life is silly. Like, life is this deeply paradoxical thing. You know, there's sometimes it's utterly nonsensical. And I just, you know, I think we're kind of surrounded by silliness. And therefore, reacting to that with an equal amount of silliness seems to me a kind of reasonably good way to get through life. And to me, silly also implies laughter and fun and the ability to laugh at oneself and the desire to make other people laugh. And again, that to me is one of the, whether life or work, actually, to me, I think that's just kind of one of the best things that anyone can do.
Are there limits to where silliness and fun can help a situation or can help people?
For sure. If you're navigating a really challenging, you know, personal situation for an employee, for example, it's not the right time to, you know, crack a joke, unless, you know, you've got through the hard stuff and then you're trying to bring a bit of levity. But I mean, you know, Mark made this point, and I think his observation of me is right. The ability to gauge when is the right time to, you know, bring that silliness and humour and levity, and when is the right time to take something very serious, is something that I'm, you know, pretty skilled at. He's definitely right in saying that I have an emotional awareness. And so not only am I there to, in whatever team I'm working in or with, not only am I there to hopefully bring some of that joyful nature to the work, I'm also, you know, I also consider it a real responsibility to understand the human experience of the people that I'm working with and empathize with that up to a point. And what I mean by that is, I also don't believe, like, very, you know, very strongly don't believe, for example, that companies are families or teams are families. It's not a family, it's a business. But equally, life is difficult. Life can be deeply challenging and very existential. And I think it's important to listen to people and make them feel heard. And so I guess there's an extent to which I'm, you know, trying to provide the circumstance for people to feel that, you know, they can be vulnerable enough to talk about something difficult that's happening to them inside or outside of work. And then equally that, you know, we're there to, at the right moments, make that work really enjoyable and fun and a little bit silly.
And being silly is another version of vulnerability.
Yes.
Because you're sort of cutting through, I don't know, a sort of importance or like even like your ego in a way. And you're just sort of like, because often it's quite challenging if like you say something really silly or crack a joke and then deadpan response, like that's really difficult and you definitely put yourself on the line. So it feels like this vulnerability is like the thread in both of those scenarios.
I think that's right, yeah. And I think it's also something about like putting people at ease and showing, to your point exactly actually, that you know, you're a human. I mean, a lot of the work that I do these days is working with founders, with leadership teams. And one of the things that I will always aim to do if I'm, for example, trying to assess the chemistry, you know, my fit to work with that team and vice versa, is ideally make them laugh and probably swear, just to sort of show I'm a human being, you know, and if you work with me, this is part of what that working experience will be like. I'll be real with you, but we should enjoy the time that we spend together. Because, you know, albeit that I work on strategy and storytelling, and that's, you know, this kind of quite arguably sort of deep intellectual exercise we're going through together to, you know, ensure that the foundations of the company are as, you know, strong as they can possibly be through those, you know, through strategy, through the story that the company is telling to the world. So much of the work is the relationship. And I believe this in that work I do now, or anything I've done in the past. And as I mentioned, I've done a lot of different things. You know, I've been an investor on, you know, more than one occasion. I've been in a venture-backed startup myself from, you know, Series A through to exit. I founded a company, kind of worked for the government. I've worked in a corporate, you know, I've experienced a lot of different contexts. And the one thing that's common to all of those contexts is that being able to cohere with people, to build relationships with people such that you can work, you know, in a way that's high functioning and high performing. It's all about the relationship.
And so you mentioned this term, the human experience. Mm. Can you go into a bit more detail as to what that means?
Work is just one part of what we do. You know, we're all of these fully fledged, multifaceted beings. And so when you come into work, you don't just assume this one mask and sit there for 8 hours and project that one side of you. You know, we're all kind of frail and nuanced and complex. And I guess I've always felt, you know, in a working context, I try to see the full human in front of me, not just the employee who has a set of objectives and, you know, a specific role to play in that business. Now, again, you know, just to reiterate the point, I don't treat that relationship like a familial one, because that's not appropriate. And it's not appropriate for that setting. But I do think that you get the best out of people in a working context when you see them as these richer, you know, fully fledged humans with interior lives and existential things that they go through. You know, life is deeply existential. Life is, you know, can be utterly fucking brilliant and deeply fucking terrible. And sometimes both those things at the same time. And, you know, we all have that human experience. So I just value trying to recognize that is true for other people and not just myself, I guess.
That feels like such a superpower, because it's such a fine line to recognize the human elements and bring more of work into your understanding within a work context, but also not go too far and not assume that you're friends or your family or something like that. Like, I don't know how that looks in practice. Can you play it out a bit?
I mean, I think I've made a lot of mistakes. So I've definitely made the mistake of treating those relationships as, you know, like friendships, or even, you know, in one particularly bad scenario, like almost like a family relationship. Had somebody who worked for me when, you know, I was running the business that I founded, and we just got into a dynamic, I would say, that was way more like a familial relationship. And how that manifested was me almost trying to slightly coddle her, I would say, and not giving feedback that was particularly accurate or meaningful. And then, so, I mean, just to, I guess, talk really, really clearly, I didn't at the time think that she was doing the best job. I wasn't giving her that feedback because I felt very loving and almost familial towards her. So I shied away from the conflict, and then it got to the point where the whole thing exploded. All of the feedback was then delivered in this, you know, one horrendous meeting, which is engraved, you know, on my soul forever, how awful it was. She felt utterly ambushed. And it was just such a lesson in, one, this relationship has kind of become something it shouldn't have. Two, I've been far too conflict averse, you know, and three, it's damaged now, the relationship of working together. And, you know, a few months after that, she left the business, and I absolutely cannot blame her at all. And so then treading that line, I guess, subsequent to that, I've been far better at doing that. And one way that I've done that is by really working on my conflict aversion, because, you know, based from prior to that incident that I was just talking to you about, I've definitely, like, the dark side of having emotional intelligence is that conflict aversion. And that's been a kind of thread, I guess, that throughout my career, that, you know, certainly when I was younger, I really was very avoidant when it came to conflict. Because, you know, I want people to feel good. You know, that's what happens when you're emotionally aware and intelligent. You want people to feel good. But the flip side of that, the dark side of that trait, the weakness of that strength, is often then not broaching a difficult topic with them when it needs to happen, you know, and not saying the things that you should be saying in order for that person then, by the way, to go on and be the best version of themselves that they can be. So that was this catastrophic kind of explosion that happened inside that business. And from that day to this, I've worked really hard on giving feedback, and giving feedback, you know, in a timely fashion, giving feedback that's realistic, and, you know, and not shying away from saying the tough things that need to be said.
I'd love to go into feedback giving and how we work on conflict aversion, but to make this lesson a bit more visceral, why was that meeting so awful?
It was because, I think because of like the family dynamic. One, she, you know, we asked her to kind of come in for this meeting. She didn't know what we were going to be talking about. And then we just kind of laid all of this stuff on her around, things that, you know, like performance issues. And then also, you know, we had heard that, she'd kind of been talking outside the business about some of, you know, about us essentially. And so all of this was just kind of laid on her, and it was just a total blindsiding. And, you know, these days I would just never let anything get to that point. The person would know way in advance of that come to Jesus meeting that there's issues that need to be worked on, and they would be given the opportunity to address those things. And then, you know, it may get to that kind of climactic point where we're like, something has to really change here. I just would never get into that situation. So it was a really hard lesson. And the reason it was quite so wounding was because I really did care about her. Again, we'd almost have this, like, I don't know, like older sister, younger sister kind of feeling into our relationship. And so I almost felt like I'd wounded somebody in my family, which is where, you know, that construct of a business as a family is so flawed, because you have to make hard decisions. Like, we are here for a reason, and it's not, you know, about it's not about family. It's about building something that has a set of outcomes that are nothing to do with that.
Do you have a relationship at all with her now?
We do. We've really worked through it completely. Yeah. Now we have a great relationship, and we both learned loads from it. It took a few years, but we have a really good relationship, and I'm super grateful for that.
And so how did you work on your conflict aversion?
With my coach. A big part of that was with my coach. So I had an absolutely amazing, amazing coach at the time, and I really did that work with her. I would say she's almost a little bit more like a psychologist slash therapist versus a traditional. She's not a traditional executive coach. And so it was really about, you know, when things were coming up for me that needed to be addressed, i.e. in a situation with somebody else, doing it, not procrastinating, not thinking about it, doing it. And actually one of those situations was me eventually leaving the business that I had founded, because the business was acquired. And I kind of knew at the point of acquisition that I probably wouldn't stay for the full entirety of the earnout. And I guess over the sort of following 18 months post the exit, that feeling of like the desire to kind of leave, you know, increased. But leaving your own company, your own creation, is an incredibly hard thing to do. There's so many complex emotions surrounding that. One, you kind of almost, you feel traitorous to your own creation. I felt traitorous to my co-founder. I felt traitorous to the people that had acquired us. Like, this is a whole complex set of emotions. However, if I hadn't worked with my coach on my conflict aversion, I probably would have stayed there years longer. So that was, you know, and it really, that stemmed from the incident that I described with my former colleague, and the knowledge that if I'm going to develop and continue to grow, I have to nail this conflict aversion thing. And then leaving the company was sort of as hard as it gets in terms of addressing a situation that I would have buried my head in the sand over for like the longest time. It was, you know, just, yeah, kind of, I don't know, like the cold water therapy of conflict aversion or something.
The tricky thing about this is that these emotions and feelings when in a business that you no longer feel is like quite right, they usually starts off small and then it kind of grows over time, right? And so you mentioned before how like you would communicate things a lot earlier, but how do you balance maybe not having complete clarity in your mind or with how you feel about a situation, but then also feeling the pull or obligation to communicate that?
I can talk about what happened then, but I can also kind of bring it more up to date with a situation that's occurred more recently. I mean, I think with this, in the situation with the business and with Gabby, co-founder, I reflected and I worked again with my coach for probably about, it probably took me about like, the thought was there and then the thought was heretical and I couldn't think the thought and I pushed the thought away and then I finally allowed the thought to rear its head and then I spoke to my coach about it and then it was probably kind of 6 months of, you know, work to get to the place where I was willing to have the conversation with him. What's been interesting with this work on conflict aversion is that the lead time or the runway has just dramatically reduced. So I also recently, you know, left a role at a venture fund. And in that scenario, I gave myself a month. So to your question, you know, how do I kind of, you know, balance the thinking time and the lack of clarity with the then, you know, the communication? In this case, I had, you know, been feeling a little bit like perhaps it wasn't, you know, I wasn't the best fit in that environment. And then I decided to give myself a month and see how I felt. Because I'm also an internal person, you know, I'm an introvert, so I process internally. And so I'm never going to be the person that has the thought and says it. So I always need that internal processing time. But it went from, you know, 6 months in that situation with Gabby to like a month this time. So, you know.
Progress.
Progress, right?
What changed about you from taking it from 6 months to 1 month?
I think really it's just that not losing a lot of the fear around confronting these things and realizing that it's just kind of, you know, an exercise in futility to prolong the inevitable, I guess. Just knowing, I think a lot of my conflict aversion, I touched on this before, a lot of my conflict aversion, you know, can come from this desire to want people to be happy and, you know, this desire because of, I guess, like, you know, the emotional awareness that I have, upsetting the apple cart is very troubling to me. But I've realized that if I truly want people to, you know, feel good around me, I need to be being authentic. And if I'm not happy and I'm not enjoying what I'm doing and I'm not bringing my full self to it, then they're not going to be happy with that either. So I guess I've kind of realized through, you know, both in professional relationships and personal relationships, that being authentic about where I'm at is a way more, creates a way more fulfilling connection.
And also the previous desire to want other people to be happy was at the detriment of your own happiness.
For sure, at times, absolutely.
So what led you to have that prioritization?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of therapy around this very topic. I think that there's something about my family background and upbringing where I'm from a family that is very loving and very expressive. But I don't know whether it's, I've tried to kind of put my finger on it. I don't know whether it's something to do with having a working class background, maybe, where you defer to others. I think there's a little bit of something of that in it. I think it's also, you know, my family, although we're very demonstrative and expressive with each other, like almost being conflict driven or angry was almost like slightly frowned upon. And so it just wasn't how I was brought up. You know, I was brought up in like quite a kind of, you know, happy sort of loving environment, and there just wasn't a ton of conflict. So I'm very unused to that as a mode of being. That just wasn't my socialization. Whereas, you know, I'm very, very attracted to people who are super forthright and say exactly how they feel and, you know, bang the table if they need to. I really respect that trait because that's, you know, the kind of opposite of me. And so whilst there's a lot of positives to, again, like having emotional awareness and emotional intelligence, not being as vocal about where I'm at is, yeah, part of the, I guess, the downside of that.
Wow, thank you for sharing. Speaking of family, your dad was, you said, a painter and generally an artist, and you have adopted that very creative side. What did you learn about creativity from your dad?
That it's the stuff of life. I mean, as you say, he is a painter, he's still a painter. And then, you know, I've got a lot of other artists and poets in my family. So it's kind of quite a sort of, you know, creative bunch, I guess. I'm not going to be particularly articulate talking about this because it's almost like this, like, feeling that possibly not going to do a good job of vocalizing, but I just think there's something incredibly wonderful about the potential and ability of human beings to create something that didn't exist before, whether that's a symphony or a novel or a beautiful painting. It kind of, to me, it just speaks of the utter potential that we have as humans. It's this almost like crystalline representation of everything that's good about humanity. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot that's bad as well. But to me, that's almost one of the pure joys, if you like, one of the really good things that we do. And so I suppose I was really always brought up with the appreciation of how much pleasure those things can bring. You know, I was like dragged around art galleries from the age of like nothing. And we were always talking about books or, you know, listening to, you know, music or going to the theatre or whatever it was. And I love to, I guess, you know, pull on those threads, you know, for themselves. So, you know, I like to write. I wrote poetry at times. I occasionally draw and paint, not as much as I would like to, because it's something that gets me really into flow when I do it. But I suppose my version, if you like, or my the way that I took that upbringing and socialization that I had was to then parlay that into business. So for me, the process of building a business is this deeply, deeply creative process. And I would almost, you know, liken it to the painter who's sitting in front of a blank canvas, or, you know, the poet who's sit, you know, got their pen ready to start writing on a blank page. It's this utter potential that you have to just build something new and different. And certainly at that point, you know, the starting point, you have all of the choices, all choices are available to you. And so for me, I guess I channeled that, my creative DNA, if you like, into that joy of, you know, like the creativity of building businesses. And I guess I mean it both on a macro and a micro level. So macro for me, how do you think about designing an organization? You know, what does that look like? And then micro, more, you know, how do we tell the story of this business? And so those, I've found myself like nourished through those things very creatively throughout my career in business.
But it does feel like, the thing that comes to mind for me is that there are some things that work for business building. There are tried and tested techniques, practices, strategies, which lay the strongest foundations from which you're able to be more creative with what you produce. But it still feels like there's a sort of container in which you can be creative with, whereas it feels like art and poetry, it feels sort of limitless. Is that a accurate sort of disparity between the two in your mind, or is that maybe a bit too simplistic?
I'm not sure I agree that art and creativity are limitless, in that if you look at any artistic tradition, there are the same kind of foundations or models. You know, you have a certain number of bars in a musical chord. You have things that work in poetry like the haiku or iambic pentameter. You have knowledge that when you apply watercolor to the page in a certain way, you know, what works to make this type of wash and what doesn't. So actually, I think like there are still a lot of the same, that there are a lot of building blocks, in the same way that you have these building blocks with a company. With a company, you know, what are your building blocks? Their ideas, their people, their, you know, maybe a physical space, their you know, market that you're obsessing over. These are the building blocks. And then you can take these building blocks and you can construct the thing that you want. So I guess I see art or the artistic process a bit more like that. You know, I'm going to use this type of guitar and this type of chord. And then, yes, I can create a song that nobody's heard before. But the containers exist in one or the other.
And so then if we take it back to the company building side and the creative side of business building, which part are you most excited and energized by?
I think the places that my mind tends to always go to is people and then storytelling. And for me, these are two fundamental, you know, foundational ingredients for any business. And so what do I mean by people? I guess what I mean is, how do you think about codifying a culture that brings people on the journey with you, that, you know, gets them kind of excited and invigorated, that, you know, means that doing your job just becomes this kind of place that, you know, I can get like pleasure and growth and joy and, you know, silliness and learning and all of those things that we talked about. And then storytelling for me is this also just incredibly important human endeavor and habit that we have always had. We've always told stories, and stories are these incredibly sticky, viral things, right? You know, if you think about fairy tales or fables, we've always told stories, and stories are this way of understanding ourselves and of, you know, transmitting that message to somebody else and passing it on. And so when you're storytelling in the context of a business, for me, one, you inherently have to clarify what the fuck you're doing to tell a good story. And so it's almost a bit of a proxy for strategy, if you like. You have to have the strategy clear in order to tell the story. So for me, they're very intertwined. So yeah, I guess those are the areas that I get super pumped by.
I'd love to go into way more detail with each. Mm. So the people side and building culture, what are your foundations that are sort of universal? And then where are the areas that you can be more creative? Mm.
The foundations, I would say, I mean, it depends what kind of business we're talking about, but let's say we're talking about a startup, relatively early stage startup in any space. The values or the culture, you know, can be starts to be manifested through these values, right? Probably like 4 to 6 values. And I think at that point of a company's life, the values have to be founder driven. The values have to, in effect, kind of come down like, you know, Moses from the mountain. Sorry, I've got lots of theological allusions. I studied theology, so it's kind of still sticks with me. But, you know, you have these almost like core principles that you want to enshrine in the business. Call them principles, call them values, call them what you will. And I think in the first instance, those have to come from the founder. And they're just, you know, these ideas about like, how do we get stuff done around here? Like, it's really nothing more simple than that. And what, you know, how can we communicate those to the people here now and then the people that will be here tomorrow and then the people that will be here in future? Although I would say I believe very strongly in the idea that everybody who comes into that business contributes to the culture. So I think what often happens is, you know, the foundational parts will be, okay, we've got these 4 or 5 values. They probably were established, you know, historically by the founder. Maybe over time those evolve. And I think you should check in with that stuff at least every 2 to 3 years and make sure, does this fit where we are today and who's here now and what we're all, you know, how we all kind of working together. The piece where I think, you know, the real creativity comes in is, okay, well, if the value is make every day an adventure, what are the practices that bring that to life? And that to me is where the team is critically important and where the team has the room for real creativity. so that you can establish the rituals, the rewards, you know, the processes, the recognition that brings Make Every Day an Adventure to life. And that's where I would absolutely invite contribution from everybody in the business. So you kind of almost have this like top-down meets bottom-up approach where, yes, there's some established foundations, but there's room for so much creativity here. And in my experience of working with tens and tens and tens of companies on this stuff, having that team involvement in the you know, the kind of inception of those practices and then also the bringing to life of them is critical, because otherwise this stuff just doesn't stick. There's no point in having values in name alone and then not bringing these things to life. In fact, if you do that, or rather when you do that, it actually has a more negative impact than having no values at all.
Can you share a story of a company you've seen do it incredibly well and then maybe one that has missed the mark?
Taking that in reverse order, one of Enron's values was integrity. I think that's a great example of a company that, you know, just failed absolutely disastrously to have any integrity whatsoever. And that's where, you know, and where that becomes so damaging is that you get you kind of arrive in a value action gap. And the value action gap just creates this huge dissonance. What that simply means is I say one thing and I do something completely different. And when you are in a situation like that in a business, that's where you start to see like deep employee dissatisfaction, you know, this sense of real mistrust, this idea that, you know, we are not, the management around us is not honest with us, deep skepticism. I was talking with a really good friend recently who, she's a fractional CPO, chief people officer, and she was talking about working in a business at the moment where there is just this innate distrust of the CEO. And so every time she goes out and she tries to do something with the people in the business, the default reaction she gets is skepticism, because I would assume that, you know, leadership team has found themselves in a value action gap where they've said one thing and they've done completely the opposite. And that's when then you start to, you know, I mean, this is all, I guess I want to, you know, be really clear in saying not just fluff. That's when you start to really feel the pain of this stuff commercially, you know, staff attrition, high levels of churn, low levels of productivity, lack of direction, lack of shipping. All of those things kind of start to kick in at points like this. So, it's really important to be intentional about this stuff and to walk the walk, you know, when you establish those sorts of systems inside a business. You asked me also about a company that I've seen do this really well. The one I guess that kind of came to mind, one I know, and one I guess I'm just more aware of by reputation, but it's a big fintech business called TrueLayer, doing kind of super well, two Italian founders, and just really worked very hard on this stuff from day one. Designed a really clear set of values, very clear, very simple values that were framed as imperative or directive. I think, you know, one of the other sort of challenges or pitfalls that companies can fall into is using a single word like integrity. It's super ambiguous. What does that mean? Nobody really knows what that means. Whereas if you use an imperative like make every day an adventure, it's much clearer what is meant by that. You can ask the employee intuit quite clearly, like, how am I supposed to behave. You know, I kind of understand what, you know, is expected of me. But I also, it sets up this value exchange. Okay, so if I'm to make every day an adventure, what is it? How do you give me the environment where I can be adventurous? And so also requires the employer to do something in return. Anyway, I mean, coming back to the example of Trulair, I think the reason they've done it really well, it's quite a distributed remote team. They have embedded the value set into their hiring processes. You know, they kind of celebrate using the values that they have. They have just been, they've just nurtured those things from day one. It's very easy to kind of come up with a set of principles, like throw them up on a wall somewhere and then never do anything with them. But if you, again, they almost become this filter to say, okay, like, you know, what does this mean in the personal development process, and how can we bring those values to life as we support people in their growth? And, you know, what does this mean when we spend time together that's, you know, not work time? And what does this mean for the way that we talk, actually, in our tonality? And when you start to pull threads from the values into all of those things, you just create this coherent, like cohesive way that we do things. So for me, you know, examples like Trulair and others, the other one that I had in my head was Airbnb. And because I just think they've done such a good job of really, like, again, love them or hate them, they crystallize this core sense of purpose, you know, which is about this idea of belonging. And then they pull that through everything that they do. I read this great kind of story from Airbnb where they'd realized that their hiring process was terrible, and they actually took their UX and design team off product and redeployed them onto the hiring process and had them completely rebuild the hiring process to really optimize for this kind of North Star of maximum candidate satisfaction, whether you get the job or don't get the job. And they completely reworked that entire process. And where, and I've had friends who've gone through this, you know, hiring process, had a terrible time, then, you know, they deployed this, rolled it out everywhere. And, you know, the goal there is, like, whether I got the job or not, I want to be walking out into the world saying that company is amazing. And that company treated me so well through that process, even though, you know, I didn't end up getting the job, because they then become an evangelist, an advocate who takes that story with them and goes out into the world and tells that story.
Love that you linked it back to storytelling as well. It feels like a good checklist, or a good way to create a checklist of where the value should be clearly defined, is basically any interaction humans have within the company. Mm-hmm. It's how do we write emails? Mm-hmm. Like, tone of voice, I would never have thought of in terms of, like, how do we communicate from a tone of voice perspective, from a body language perspective, do we have our phones out on the table in a meeting or during a lunch or something like that? But then also to customer service, how we write emails, etc. But that's all downstream of having really strong values in the first place. And so how do you help founders solidify their values?
For me, there's this, like, indelible link or this red thread between why we exist, our purpose, and how we do things, our values. So you almost need to address this why question before you address the how question. And how do you get to that why? For me, it really is this process of taking a step back and asking these quite existential questions. So, you know, who is the customer? You know, like, what do they care about? What makes us different? what kind of impact do we want to have? What don't we want to do? You know, these sorts of questions, when you ask yourself those questions, you themes will start to emerge, and it will almost be, you know, it almost the why question almost answers itself. The origin story of the company is really important, in my opinion, for this why question. I had the luck of working with so many purpose-driven founders who kind of were obsessed by a specific problem, and it was that obsession that drove them to build the business. So, I mean, to give an example, I worked with a business who were obsessed with completely reimagining how debt works and debt collection services, because they had this observation that the way that people get treated if they are in debt and they are subject to having to deal with a debt collection agency, it's just a horrific experience. And that person is already going through this deeply like difficult emotional time, like financially unstable time, and then they have to go through that horrific experience. And the founders of the business were completely like obsessed. I mean, it's not the sexiest topic by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a topic that affects like millions of people, and that we almost kind of take for granted. It's like just one of those really deeply unsexy things that, I mean, I certainly don't think about that. It's not a thing that I'm obsessed with, but I think it's completely remarkable that these founders were deeply obsessed with that and go on to build this business. So their why is along the lines of helping everybody to be, you know, financially empowered and equal wherever they are. I'm paraphrasing, but it's along those lines. Now, once you have something like that as a purpose or a why, you can say, okay, so what does that mean for how we do things? Like, and you can also ask yourself some questions when you're establishing the values, you know, what are the features of working here? What are the benefits of working here? What kind of people thrive here? What do we care about? You know, what don't we want to do? Against those same sort of questions. But if I'm operating a business that's all about like financial inclusion, for example, and empowerment, you can quite easily make the leap to saying, well, one of our values absolutely has to be about empowerment. It has to be about this business of whether I'm inside the company, whether I'm a customer outside the company, you know, the ability to feel empowered has to be a key part of what we're doing. And so there's this kind of causal link between, you know, this idea of we exist to address, you know, to ensure that everyone can feel financially empowered and equal. And how do we do that? Well, you know, one of our values might be, you know, make it happen. It's kind of like an empowerment flavored value, right? So if make it happen is the value, then okay, so I'm then, I can just get on and make it happen. Like you're giving me accountability within my job role to experiment and to do things. But then equally, what are you going to give me in order for me to make it happen? Does that mean you give me like downtime on a Friday to work on, you know, an off roadmap problem that I've been wanting to solve? Or does that mean that I have X amount of L&D budget? Like, what does that look like? And then what does make it happen look like from a tonal perspective? What does that mean for how we speak to each other, for how we act, and then for the stories we put out into the world?
So it looks like you've actually not just only used the why to find the how in terms of the values, but also the what as well. I heard you, like, most of your questions were also, what are the features of working here? What type of person thrives here? What does that look like? And so you're again doing sort of top down, bottom up to then reach the middle ground, which I think is fascinating. So given that we've spoken about stories, on the other side of things, that was the people side, looking at the story side, what do you feel are the foundations of storytelling, and then what are the elements which we can get more creative?
I come back to this idea of the why as being like a fundamental building block, because if we can express our purpose clearly, that's how we again take people on the journey with us. I mean, if you think at this very atomic level, everything that you do as a human has a why behind it. You deciding to build the offering that you're building, you know, doing these interviews, becoming a content creator, you're not just, you wake up one day and just think that sounds fun. Like, there's a why that's deeply motivating you to do that. Even something as simple as going for a walk, there's a why that's motivating you to do that. It's good for my health. I'd like some fresh air. You know, it helps my mental well-being when I'm, you know, walking in the forest. There's always this why for everything that we do as humans. And the same is true for the company. There should be this why. And when you can convincingly and compellingly articulate that why, it starts to resonate, hopefully, with the customers, the shareholders, you know, the partners, the fans that go, I believe in that why too. You know, I really care about reimagining debt or helping people belong anywhere, or, you know, whatever that may be. It's not going to appeal across to the board to everybody, but it's going to appeal to the people that are motivated by that same kind of intrinsic motivation. So for me, that why sits at the heart of, yes, culture and values, but also storytelling. And teasing that out again, you know, kind of going back to that question, that process of asking yourself questions. And then when you have that and you have it well articulated, again, it's almost this like red thread that everything can kind of unfurl from. So whether we're telling a story to a customer, even if you're talking, for example, at the level of the product, and again, let's use that idea of empowerment that we talked about earlier. If I am delivering value proposition messaging at the level of the product, I still want to be like kind of checking in with that deep why and delivering a story around that product that makes the person feel empowered, like that's kind of connecting into that sense of empowerment. And then, for example, if the story I'm telling is to an investor, you know, that element needs to be there, and it should also be reflected in, you know, the visual design and the visual language. So again, this is not, you know, the best example, but just alighting on that as an idea, that idea of empowerment. How do you tell the story around that? Well, you know, you build a narrative that has that kind of tonality and language and those ideas. You figure out how does that translate into product design. You reflect in values. You weave that into your fundraising narrative. And then you have, again, this like red thread that runs through everything. So where can you become creative? I mean, in all manner of ways, and all of the things that I've just said. Again, if you can think about, like, so what does empowerment look like in product design, in UX design? What does it look like in the email newsletters that we send to people? Like, what does it look like when we write press releases? What does it look like when we're creating in-app copy? Like, you know, it's kind of endless, like what you can do with it. And your interpretation of that as this intrinsic motivation is where the creativity comes in.
And so is it right of me to assume that most people don't spend enough time clarifying their why, which then is sort of the building blocks of all of these different stories? Or is it a different part of the storytelling process?
I think it's not that. I think quite a few people have thought about their purpose, but then they haven't necessarily like pulled the threads through into these other stories that they need to deliver, these other places they need to, you know, deliver the message. So, for example, I might, you know, talk to a founder who says, I'm all about like financial inclusion. Like that's really what kind of motivates me. And, you know, wanting to sort of deliver that as simply and clearly to people as possible. And then you look at their fundraising deck and there are 500 words on every slide and they're using jargon, language, technical language that no one understands. That's not inclusive. It's not simple. It's not clear. So I think what often happens is that there's almost this like proto thought or this kind of core idea, this intrinsic motivation. It always exists. It's always there. But it's like the teasing out and then the translating of that into all of the different touch points that some people do brilliantly and some people just haven't quite been able to like pull that through and then deliver that consistent story across every different touch point. And so in the financial inclusion example, well, that investment narrative is diametrically opposed to being inclusive because super hard to read and I don't understand the language. So nothing inclusive about that. I mean, it's a silly example, but you get the point.
Well, you're a silly person, so it's perfect.
Exactly. I'm not sure if that's very clear.
I think it is very, very clear. And it's just this sort of filter by which we need to sort of keep asking ourselves.
It's exactly that. I often talk about it as it's this lens that we look through. So we look through this lens and it informs everything. So again, everything from the notification message you get to the app to the ads that we would run, you know, to the, you know, social campaigns, to the very, you know, kind of deep sort of low level strategic narrative that we might create.
It feels like whenever we're creating anything new within a business, be it a new ad, a new product, a new deck, a new piece of messaging, this should be our first port of call to say, what is our why? How is that expressed here? How could it be? What are our values? How are they potentially expressed here?
Exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. And what that generates is utter consistency, and the best brands are utterly consistent. If you think about brands you love and brand experiences you love, it's because those brands are utterly consistent in everything they do. You know, I love Nike, addicted to Nike, terribly, horribly so. That is a super consistent brand experience. And Nike's this great example because, you know, we all know the Nike, the super famous, like, you know, the swoosh and just do it as the tagline. You know, Nike's purpose is to bring innovation and inspiration to every athlete in the world. And then there's the asterisk on athlete, and the asterisk reads, if you have a body, you are an athlete. And the perfect, you know, the tagline is the perfect encapsulation of that idea. You are an athlete, I'm an athlete, we're all athletes, just do it, you can do it, just do it. And the great thing about the Nike brand is that it just has this infinite scalability, so they can go utterly, you know, mainstream and high street, and you know, every kid, you know, in London has like Air Force Ones, or they can go like super, super high end and, you know, do these like amazing design collaborations and Nike Studio and whatever it may be. So they have this elasticity as a brand to be both utterly mainstream and super, super high end. But the experience is consistent everywhere, and that sentiment is consistent everywhere. I mean, Apple is another great example of this utter consistency in the brand experience. And so what these tools are for is the generation of that consistency. And once you have that consistency, you have committed, you know, fangirls like me who are just there for all of it and along for the journey and completely addicted. And so it's both about, I think, inspiring, you know, this intrinsic motivation and helping people feel purposeful at work. Like, I'm driven by this idea of empowerment. I'm driven by this idea of everybody can be an athlete. I'm driven by this idea of financial inclusion. And then the commercial outcomes that that generates, because again, it's not a family, it is a business. So of course, we're always driving towards powerful commercial outcomes. But this for me is sort of partly where the creative and the commercial fuse. Because if you can get, you know, that creativity and those foundational elements in your business right, then you generate, you know, authentically the results that you want commercially.
Wow. And so what is your why?
Damn it. It's a really good question. I'm a firm believer in the concept of why for businesses, because I think that businesses can have a singular purpose and should have a singular purpose to drive that kind of consistency and clarity of focus. I don't quite believe in the same thing for a human. I think we can actually have a number of whys. Sort of slightly also don't believe in the idea of the one, you know, I believe in the ones. So rather than have one why, I believe in, you know, a number of whys. There's also, I suppose the other way I might be tempted to answer that question is that, you know, I'm a bit of a closet existentialist and, you know, also slightly believe that like life is a bit purposeless, and in accepting that you kind of find meaning, but let's not go down that philosophical rabbit hole.
Definitely want to go there later on. Later on.
I can't answer your question right now. I don't think I have a clearly defined why. And I think that's probably because I've been in somewhat of a transition period.
I really like what you said in terms of we have lots of different whys. Mm. And I have two questions off the back of that. One is more practical, which is in the early stages of company building, the company's why is driven by the founders. Mm-hmm. And it's usually linked to their whys, plural, right? Mm-hmm. So how should a founder distinguish between a why of theirs that's suitable to bring into the business versus one that isn't as relevant?
For me, I guess the why at the, you know, in terms of the company as an entity, it has to have some relevance to ultimately the thing that you're building and the impact that, you know, you intend to have with the business. So whilst, you know, it may not feel completely, whilst I may not be entirely comfortable with like defining a why for myself, I believe that other people do define whys for themselves and have heard some really good examples of that from people about what they believe about their individual existence, let's say. But those personal whys don't always map to the why that the company should have. So I guess maybe I would make a distinction between, you know, what do I find fulfilling as a human? What is that kind of intrinsic driver or motivation for me? I mean, let's just hypothetically say, like, my motivation has something to do with making people laugh, just for the sake of argument. It's probably not the most relevant thing necessarily in a company context, unless I'm building a new comedy club, I don't know, which could happen.
Or Moonpig.
Yeah, exactly. Again, to, you know, kind of hark back, I guess, to those examples that we were talking about before, you know, if you're Airbnb, you're going to root that sense of why and this idea, these ideas about belonging, not something completely random about like, we're, you know, is this to like make people laugh? So there has to be relevance to the thing that you want to build, the market you want to operate in, this problem that you're seeking to solve. So maybe that's a better way to talk about it. I think that the purpose has to map to the problem that you're seeking to solve, or, you know, the intervention you're trying to make, or, you know, the solution you're trying to create.
So then I'd like to go back to the purposelessness.
Easy for you to say.
Human experience. But maybe before we go to there, you are an avid fan of Soren Kierkegaard. Can you explain who Soren Kierkegaard is and how that has, how he has influenced your view on existentialism?
He's very fresh in my mind, actually, because I just went to visit his grave. So he is a Danish philosopher. He's thought of really as one of the forefathers of existentialism. So, you know, the most obvious existentialists being like Sartre, Camus, etc. Kierkegaard was a, you know, precursor really, and along with Nietzsche, thought of, you know, as these forefathers of existentialism. I don't know why I just fell in love with him when I was a kid, really. And I then wrote my dissertation on him when I studied theology and philosophy. And I suppose the thing that I just liked about him and what was very meaningful to me was, so he talks, for example, about there being like these kind of three phases of existence. He talks about when you're younger, you're living in the kind of aesthetic phase, you have this butterfly existence, you know, you're kind of very social and you're, you know, you're out in the world and maybe you're kind of partying and, you know, like you just, you and rightly so, you're quite irresponsible. And then he talks about this kind of ethical phase of existence that you move into after that, where you probably take on more responsibility and you, you know, contribute to your community. Maybe you have a family. And then he talks about this third phase of life, which he calls the religious, which is almost this, you know, kind of, and he uses this idea of the leap of faith, which you can take from the ethical existence into the religious. But very few people take it because very few people are, you know, kind of able, I guess, so deeply to like kind of immerse themselves into, you know, the spirituality and the relationship with the religious or God. So most of us spend our lives in either, you know, the aesthetic or the ethical. And I suppose I was just kind of mystified by this idea of like, what does that religious phase of existence look like and what does that really mean? And another thing that I liked about him was that he was working at a time when the church in Denmark was very much the prevailing kind of source of authority. And he talks about all of these ideas in a way where whatever the religious is to you is this deeply personal thing. And the relationship you have to the religious or the spiritual, as we might call it, is this deeply personal thing. And it's not about going to church or the taxes you pay or, you know, the congregation that you're part of or the rituals that get performed, you know, in this certain building every Sunday. It's almost this dialogue you're having, this direct dialogue you're having with whatever is the religious to you and whatever's the spiritual to you. And I just thought that that was such a, for the time that he was working, kind of a revolutionary idea, really. And so I suppose, you know, why did that go on to influence existentialism? I think it was partly that he talked about how that was very kind of subjective personal experience. And then if you look at kind of the work of the existentialists, I guess they talk a lot about, you know, life being this kind of deeply subjective experience as well. And I just found those ideas really compelling, I guess.
So to ask a very personal question, what's your relationship with the religious or spiritual?
It's a really good question, one I've thought a lot about because, as I mentioned, I studied theology. I'm from a religious family. A lot of my family are Jehovah's Witnesses. So I've always been surrounded by a lot of religion and studied a lot of religion. And I think when I was younger, when I was doing my degree, firmly believed that religion was a human construct and that it was much more of a sociological phenomenon. And I think my view has definitely changed over time. I'm not a believer in any dogma, any organized faith by any stretch of the imagination, but I do believe in a lot in energy and spiritual connection. I know you spoke to my friend Hannah. She's definitely somebody that I have that with, for example, assuming you did speak to her. So, I guess I struggle to tell you more than that because I do think this is one area where, despite being a storyteller, language is quite insufficient.
Oh, that is so powerful in and of itself. And, of course, I spoke to Hannah.
Oh, my goodness. In the car, classic.
So what I really love about her is...
She just makes me laugh.
She's incredibly sensitive in all ways, but incredibly emotionally sensitive, really deeply empathetic. And with that, I think this is what I'm going for. She's a deeply exquisite being. I find she kind of oozes a real ethereal exquisiteness. Like, I think that's something else I really love about her. There's a depth to everything she does. So nothing is done as a simple process, a mechanical process. There's a real depth of kind of, yeah, cogitation around absolutely everything and consideration. She's deeply considerate. But at the same time, I was like, but she's just like punk. Like, you know, she's kind of like deeply sort of like impish and really, really, really naughty. So I think something that will certainly bring a slight giggle to her face is like a midnight flit from a rooftop into an Indian temple elephant enclosure. With a man walking on his hand.
Oh, brilliant.
So I think that summarises this balance of depth and thought and consideration.
I can totally see now why you say people say you make them cry. That made me feel very emotional seeing me. Sorry to interrupt, but...
Don't be. Mm. We're getting into the end, but I absolutely love this, and I think given we've had a lot more depth, and Hannah gave us a slight foot in the door of like a more silly part of your history in terms of a midnight flit in India, the question that she would ask you,
here we go,
if she was in my shoes, was, what's under your bed?
Do you know what, at the moment, is that I can't tell if that's a genuine question or not. That sounds like Hannah being very impish to me. Actually, at this moment in time, absolutely nothing. Whatsoever, apart from quite a lot of dust.
Interesting. What does that say about you?
I have these grubby, unkempt corners of my mind, I think is what it says about me.
That's phenomenal. Last two questions, and we have to wrap it up. Given that the focus of this podcast is all about connections and people, mm-hmm. Of which you are a master and have had so much thought and personal experience with, mm-hmm. I'd love to know who has had a outstanding impact on you.
Mm-hmm. My dad, definitely. I think that I touched on this earlier, but actually a lot of the things that Hannah said about me, which were really lovely, I would say about him. And I just feel incredibly, intensely grateful to have had this consistent influence in my life, which was about the beauty in the world. And that's really how I would sum up what he's given me, is just this ability to look at the world and see the beauty and in both people, nature, and the things that we create, because it can be wild and a bit bleak out there, but I feel like I have this innate optimism because of him consistently showing me that lens to look through.
That's so beautiful. What about in a more professional sense?
I struggle to come up with a singular person, but the people that I'm most grateful for having worked with are, it's going to sound weird, but almost always the people that I've hired, because I've just always like learned so much from them. I think there's something like really wonderful about like the opportunity to work with people that are younger, kind of have so much enthusiasm, because I think when you go on that, you know, journey of like developing somebody, or what, you know, trying to create the circumstances for them to develop, you naturally develop yourself. There's this like beautiful symbiotic process when, you know, you're working with somebody and you know, seeking to kind of create the conditions for their growth, but they will, you know, also kind of teach me so much at the same time. So I would say I've been super lucky to work with like more than I can mention brilliant sort of people that have, you know, been on that kind of journey with.
That's such a beautiful and humble answer. So thank you. Last thing, you've been very generous with coming here, giving your time and sharing so much wisdom and experience. Assuming that this is listened to by millions of entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs, what is something that that sort of audience could support you with?
I mean, I would just like love to work in a world where people are really intentional about company design in the way that we've described. So honestly, like, I would just love to, for people to, if any of this has been helpful, to deploy it and to kind of implement it. And if they need help doing that, I would be very happy to talk about it. But yeah, I guess like I would just love to live in that world where we're building these human-centered businesses.
That's a beautiful way to close. Thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Loved it. Thank you. You're an awesome interviewer.